Welcome to Lingthusiasm, a podcast that's enthusiastic about linguistics. I'm Lauren Gorn.
And I'm Gretchen McCulloch. And in this Patreon bonus episode, we get enthusiastic about how science fiction imagines the futures of English. But first, thank you to everyone who came to the February 2023 live show Q&A with Dr. Kirby Conrad. It was so great to see everyone with all your questions and lively participation in the chat.
We'll have that episode in your feed as our April bonus if you missed the recording or if you want to listen again. You can also revisit some of the questions and comments in the Listen Along chat channel of the Lingthusiasm Patreon Discord.
I feel like I've been reading several different science fiction books recently that all do some interesting things with how they're projecting an imagined future for the English language in the context of what their books are trying to do. And I thought we could talk about a few different books that are doing different interesting things there.
I guess that makes sense because a lot of sci-fi starts off with a like, what if we fast forward from now into a future? And in the now, a lot of us speak English, so we fast forward and see what English is doing in these imagined futures. And it also makes sense to me that you would be paying attention while reading those books.
Look, I don't turn the linguist part of my brain off. So this is something that's going on. Let's name the books in the series that we're looking at the top in case anyone wants to go do quite a lot of reading homework. Or if you just want to follow us along, we won't be trying to spoil like the endings of the books. We may spoil some more premise-y setup bits in the first parts of the series.
So we're going to look at Ada Palmer's Terra Ignota series, Marge Piercy's Woman on the Edge of Time, The Expanse television show and novels, and M.R. Carey's The Rampart Trilogy, which is The Book of Colly and its sequels.
These are all books that highlight for us both the challenges of fitting English, which is the medium of all of these books that were originally written in English, into the world building itself, as well as the challenges of different media, because several of these books have been adapted for screen, especially the Expanse books, and how that changes in terms of what types of things you can do with the language in different formats.
As Gretchen said, we will avoid major plot spoilers, but we are going to be doing some world spoilers, or they might be just kind of teasers that make you want to pick these books up. And if you aren't interested in reading any of these, we hope that it is an opportunity to also help you think about what makes world building in English such a complex and fun challenge for sci-fi writers and readers.
So let's start with the Terra Ignota series, which begins with To Like the Lightning. These books are set about 500 years in the future, and it's a very intricate reimagining of the world after the end of nation states as the primary form of macro social organization and nuclear families as a micro form of organization, and into these sort of voluntary non-geographical strats, which are sort of take on governmental functions, and also these more flexible, voluntary domestic settings called bashes, which are sort of a larger household type situation that people live in.
The first of these four books came out in 2016, and I was very unsurprised, Gretchen, when you told me that apparently Ada Palmer started world building on these in the early 2000s, because you used the word intricate, and I think that's a pretty good indicator of the level of detail and thought that has gone into thinking about how a world without nuclear families and nation states would function 500 years in the future.
And one of the things that I think a lot of people paid attention to, and certainly caught my attention when they came out in 2016, which is somehow both long ago and not that long ago, it's when we started this podcast, for example. And in 2016, a lot of people were paying attention to that in this world of To Like the Lightning and its sequels, the characters themselves aren't using gendered pronouns to refer to each other. Everyone uses they. And the narrator has decided to write this book in this deliberately archaizing style where he's using these old-fashioned these and thous and he's and she's to create this particular type of peculiar effect. And in the same way that, you know, readers and writers in the 2020s who are using these and thous for a stylistic archaizing effect, we did a whole episode about pseudo-oldie-timey Englishes, sometimes use these and thous not the way they're actually used historically. The narrator is doing weird things with he's and she's in the narration and sort of using them for stylistic effect, not the way that contemporary writers are using those words.
It's not clear from the books why people stopped using gendered pronouns, whether it was like a slow social evolution or some kind of like formal change in how society operated. But what I find very funny is that like some characters are really transgressive by dressing up gendered or using gendered pronouns. And this very unreliable central narrator is really part of this subversive secret thing where, you know, sometimes people will dress up in kind of corsets or suits.
Sort of 18th century ball gowns and things like that that are deliberately got this sort of retro gender attached to them. The thing that I find that's very interesting about To Like the Lightning and its sequels in relation to future of English is the relationship of the writing process of these books themselves and how they in some ways inhabit the future that they're also trying to predict.
Yeah.
Because Ada Palmer started working on the books of the world building in the early 2000s, started trying to sell the first book in 2008, finally sold it in 2013, and then it comes out in 2016. And she's described in various panels and interviews and things that her early beta readers found the singular they in the book very interesting and, you know, sort of distracting and difficult to parse. And by this point, even by the time the fourth one came out in 2021, I was like, oh, yeah, this is just a pretty normal thing that I read now, even compared to when I read the first one in 2016. So, you know, the books are set 500 years in the future, but the evolution of language happened over the course of conceiving of and writing and publishing these books in a way that was actually very fast over this sort of 20-year time span.
Yeah, she was kind of predicting the future just like 5 years, not 500 years of future.
Yeah, like they're on a curve themselves in terms of the publication process, not just in terms of trying to project 500 years into the future.
I think I started reading these books in around 2018 and noticed what she was doing. At that point, singular they was becoming part of my active grammar. But I hadn't realized how much singular they had become part of my active grammar until there's a character in the book that has a preferred pronoun of it. Mm-hmm. And I really struggle with adult humans, personally in my own grammar, to have it as a pronoun for a human. And it was interesting to have this like thing that I had completely absorbed into my grammar and this thing that was challenging for me to read.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see where the books go with the sort of gender politics of this world, which at first glance seems like it's, all right, look, we've abolished gender and sort of solved everything, and then realizing that actually the gender situation is more complicated than that, and there's still some things that need to be figured out even within that world, which I think adds an interesting level of complexity.
I also enjoyed how the narrator played around. There's at least one or two characters where, depending on how the narrator feels about them and their actions and their personality, will use he or she for the character, and deliberately playing around with gender in a way that we don't necessarily do with pronouns a lot in contemporary English writing.
Yeah, and I think this point of comparing how To Like the Lightning landed versus how the final book landed, even just in a 5-year time span and over the course of the series written, is even more stark for the next book that I want to talk about, which is called Woman on the Edge of Time. And it was written by Marge Piercy and published in 1976.
Oh, this is one I have not read. So I look forward to hearing about, I mean, we are living in a future English for Marge Piercy because this is 50 years ago.
Right. So here's a book that's written in the past. It's set partly in the 1970s and it's set partly in visions of the future about 150 years in the future from the 70s.
We're a third of the way there.
Yeah, which is actually only like 100 years in the future now. So you get that sort of time dilation process even more strongly, where in many ways the world of the 70s that the half of or more of the narration is inhabiting is also quite alien to me, even though it's a historical world that is a relatively real world that people lived in. I mean, obviously it's fictional in the case of the particular book, but she does a lot of research into the particular context that she's writing in and is certainly writing from having lived in that period and so on and so forth. So, yeah, the specific world of the past there is also something that is sort of alien to me.
And how does Marge Piercy, who's thinking in the 1970s, think about projecting forward into a future?
Right. So because she's got these two timelines going on, the contemporary 70s world is sort of very dystopian. There's a character who's going in and out of mental hospitals and really having a very rough time with it, who's getting visions of a future from 150 years in the future where they've sort of solved all of these problems. There's no more poverty. There's no more inequality. There's no more of many of the things that are very much affecting this character's life in the 1970s. And all of the sort of social movements, feminism and anti-racism and things have all succeeded at their objectives. And what could this world look like that she could be living in?
So a kind of utopia in the way that the Terra Ignota books also project forward to a world where, at least at the beginning, we feel like they've solved the current social problems that we have.
Right. And the people in that future, that imagined future, are sort of, I don't know that they've abolished gender in the same way of the Terra Ignota books, but they've made a world where gender distinctions that are super relevant for Connie, that's our viewpoint character, that are super relevant for Connie's life, that, you know, really limit what she can do as a woman, that where gender distinctions don't matter.
Right.
So you can identify as a man or a woman, but there's not, and I don't think explicitly there are non-binary characters in this because she's writing it in the 70s, but she has sort of an expansive view of gender coming from the 70s. But they've abolished any sort of gender-related roles.
Right.
So all children have three parents, and explicitly all children actually have three mothers.
Okay.
And you have artificial wombs, so no one's gestating babies, and everyone is taking the hormones that let them breastfeed their babies.
Right. So a very 70s kind of pushing back against what was very male-dominated language at the time, deliberately choosing a feminine form of the language where possible.
Right. And so it's not saying, you know, that every child has three parents. It's saying every child has three mothers. And, you know, there's this scene in the book with a bearded man breastfeeding a baby and being like, yeah, this is a thing that people are doing.
Right. So being a mother is distinct from being a man or a woman as a kind of ungendered role.
Right. And then, you know, and then eventually the children sort of grow up and they have aunts as well. And again, everybody can be an aunt if you want to be an aunt. But taking on the feminine form as default, rather than a book like The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin, which came out in 1969, you know, which is actually just 6 years before Woman on the Edge of Time comes out. So Marge Piercy could have read Le Guin on that book. And that's a sort of genderless future as well, or non-gendered society as well, but using he as your sort of default pronoun and the masculine thing as a sort of default thing there. Woman on the Edge of Time is like, nah, everyone's going to be mothers. But there's also a pronoun thing.
Okay.
So people in this imagined future use person with a short form per as the pronoun for everybody.
Oh, that's a novel neo-pronoun I haven't encountered before.
Yeah, I hadn't encountered it before this book, and it reads very smoothly. I think it's helped by the fact that per sort of sounds like her.
Yep.
So it feels like it's got the length associated with an English pronoun. So, you know, sort of an example sentence there, Luciente, that's the name of a character, Luciente touched per hair, that sort of thing. Or Luciente wanted Jackrabbit, which is another character, to know that person's actions were affecting per. And so person and per can both be used sort of as a longer form or a stressed form and then a shorter or weak form of the pronoun, which is also something that English does very readily. And so being able to swap between person and per also helps ease the English-speaking reader into understanding that, yeah, per is operating like a pronoun here, and here's sort of how it's being used in various contexts.
That's a really cool way to reconsider the role of pronouns in English.
Yeah. So there's a quote from the book that also sort of expresses one of the values of this futuristic society that says, per must not do what per cannot do. And also, per must do what per needs to do. So these are sort of axioms of, you know, you've got to do what you've got to do. You can't do what you can't do.
Mm-hmm.
But expressed with this sort of generic third person pronoun that's being used for everyone.
Cool. It's cool how Palmer and Piercy start with some of the challenges of gender relations and how we use language to talk about gender in their day and move that forward into an imagined world that they would like to see. And in some ways for both of them, kind of the world moves into that space as well. I think that's what makes it extra interesting that we are a lot less constrained in our gender roles than we were in the 1970s. And that there is this opening up beyond a gender binary that Ada Palmer's books have kind of written into as well.
Yeah, there's this really interesting moment in Woman on the Edge of Time where the 70s character is interacting with the future character, and Connie, the 70s character, initially reads Luciente, who's the future character, initially parses her as a man because her body language looks confident.
Oh, poor Connie.
I know. You know, and there's sort of like gender sort of exists, but gender roles don't. So Luciente's like, oh, yeah, no, I'm a woman. But it's, you know, not a big deal because this doesn't actually matter in our society. And Connie's like, whoa, like I didn't realize this because she seemed confident and open. And I was talking about this with a friend who's sort of a generation older than me and saying, yeah, that was really interesting to that book because I don't think I do that. And my friend's like, oh, I absolutely do parse people's gender based on, you know, certain things about confidence. And I was like, I don't think that's relevant in my generation.
Interesting.
So that's a way in which I'm sort of inhabiting a world that's closer to that future world than the 70s world, at least to some extent.
Of course, gender is only going to feature in the way you play with English if gender features as a theme in the books that you're writing or the books that you're reading. That's not the only way to play around with English. And so there are other themes that come up in the next two series that we're going to talk about. The first one of which is The Expanse. So I've been watching this TV show. It's just wrapped up after 6 seasons. Gretchen, I know you're not much of a television watcher, so thanks for reading the first book in the series.
So I read the first book, Leviathan Wakes, and I think this is an interesting case where we can actually do some comparison between the TV show and the book, because you've watched the TV show and not read the book. I've read at least the first book. You didn't quite catch me early enough to get me to read the entire series, but I think this sort of gives us a start to talk about some of the stuff that's going on there.
So in the world of The Expanse, it's a future where humankind has expanded out into the solar system beyond planet Earth. So Mars is an independent state in the process of being terraformed, but there's lots of people who live on Mars. And there are also people living on moons and asteroids further out in the asteroid belt. And these kind of create three large political social entities. And that group that live out on the asteroid belt, they have far fewer resources and far less access to resources. And they're known as belters, and they've developed their own way of speaking in the world, which is known as belter Creole.
Yeah, and this has been something that people have requested us to talk about on the podcast for a long time, because it is sort of a distinctive aspect of these books, and especially the TV show. Mm-hmm. And I think what I knew before going into this was that the books had some degree of material about this language, but then the TV producers hired a linguist named Nick Farmer to produce a more expanded version of the language for the TV show, because if you're going to have characters having entire bits of dialogue, then you actually want someone to come up with sort of a proper grammar and develop the vocabulary and have someone on call to come up with what they're going to say.
And even the authors of the books have acknowledged that the TV show does a much richer job of it, and that the TV show is canon belter Creole, and that the books kind of had something that was, we could maybe consider like a placeholder for it.
Yeah, there's a great interview with Nick Farmer for Ars Technica with Annalie Newitz talking about this, and he very diplomatically refers to it as a placeholder for the more expanded version. So we can give a few examples, I think, of belter Creole from the books.
Sure.
So this is from chapter 2 of the first book, so hopefully not too spoilery. And a character says, "And then it was all pow, room full up with blade boys howling and humping shank," the girl said, waving a hand. "Looked like a dance number, except that Bomi's got this look. He don't know nothing never and ever, amen. You know, Kay?" And then other character goes, "I totally," Miller said. His voice had taken on the twang of an inner level resident. He waved his hand in the same lazy arc the girl had used. Bomi he didn't see. Forgotten arm. And then another little bit is, "Follow Kay?" Miller asked. "Bonnie vacuate like losing air," the girl said with a chuckle. "Banghead hops. Kenneth too?" "Ken," Miller said. "Now, all new blade boys. Overhead. I'm out." So to me, as somebody who has some French, has some German, has some Spanish, something like Kenneth too or K at the end of a sentence to make it a question, this is like, yeah, I can figure out what's going on here because I know a couple of these languages. But there's also a bit of a tension for me because the book says in text that the belter Creole developed from a mix of a bunch of European languages, Chinese, Russian, you know, all the Romance languages, German, you know, Zulu. And I'm not seeing any influence from Chinese, from Russian, from Zulu, none of which I speak. But I recognize all of the roots for the vocabulary in this language because I don't speak any of these other languages that are supposedly also influencing it.
It's also very, very strongly English. And a Creole normally has, you know, a language like English that it takes a lot of inspiration from, and then one or many more other languages. But you wouldn't expect it to be quite so easy to read as an English speaker. But then, you know, it is a book. You've got to get through it. You don't have the luxury of subtitles like you do with a TV show. So there's some tensions there around helping the reader through while also trying to be representative, but very European skewed for sure, in a way that I didn't necessarily think happened with the TV show. I think Nick Farmer did a much better job of that.
Yeah, you're also an English speaker, Lauren. Did you feel like you understood the things that were being said in belter Creole from the TV show, or were you relying on subtitles and things?
I was definitely relying on subtitles for a lot of it. I don't know how much of that is a reflection of just how much was non-English and how much of it was individual actor pronunciation. But I also noticed there was both the belter Creole, which did draw on words from a lot of different languages, but there is also this quite interesting range of accents that people do when they are playing belters who are speaking English to English speakers, or sometimes bizarrely English to each other when there's no English speakers in the room. And sociolinguistically, the social setup is that the Earthers all speak standard contemporary American English. I don't know how far in the future this is set, but we often find that people use American and British English as like the default. Our contemporary default English is the contemporary default of the future.
And particularly those like prestigious Hollywood, you know, BBC varieties. If you're going to use some sort of more regional variety or a more ethnically associated variety, they're probably going to be marked. They try to use that very like Hollywood white English to show something, which is an issue we'll get back to when we talk about Tale of Kolia in a minute.
There is one random guy from Mars that has a Texan accent, and I don't know if this was like just an individual quirk of the character or what.
Ah, so I actually have an answer for that from the books.
Oh, okay.
Which is that according to the books, Mars was settled by this group that included a substantial portion of people from Texas. Ah. And so everybody from Mars, or at least this region of Mars, canonically has a Texan accent. So that's world building that was in there.
Wow, that is actually explained in the world building, because it was quite strong and intentional and persistent. And I couldn't tell if it was just meant to be indicating something about this character, but it is actually about the world building for how Mars came about. How fascinating.
The future contains Texan Martians. I don't think this is a decision that comes across as strongly when it comes to the written form, because you do have characters who are speaking in sort of Belter Creole, which is sort of clearly marked, and then you have characters who are speaking in what looks like fairly standard written English, like the variety of the text. But I'm just someone who knows that when individual people with different accents read that out loud, they could be saying it with a lot of different accents. And that's not necessarily something that shows up in writing unless you're doing a very specific attempt to try to represent a particular accent or dialect, like with the Texan Martian. So it's not something that actually comes across quite as strongly in the written work that the characters have quite such, you know, 2020s Hollywood generic accents.
I think the real tension and sometimes awkwardness for me is that there's this tension between future sociolinguistic realities and our current sociolinguistic reality, where you have some belter characters that are played by white people doing these very non-standard accents, where you kind of make the consonant clusters at the ends of words more simple, or you kind of simplify the verbs. And some of them can come across like almost like what is sometimes jokingly known as a Jafaican accent in multicultural London English, where white people are putting on these accents that you normally find in minoritized communities. And some of the actors do better and some do a less better version of that. And like in your imagined future, that's fine. But in our contemporary reality, watching a person put on this accent can occasionally feel a bit uncomfortable.
It seems in our contemporary world as an issue that could also have been solved by having the actors themselves be black or brown or other people who have an accent closer to that in maybe the rest of their lives. And so it would be less weird that they would be putting on this accent. Like there's a tension there.
Yeah, I don't think it's surprising that one of the most convincing characters linguistically on the show for me was Naomi Nagata, who is played by Dominique Tipper. And she's a British actress. And depending on who she's speaking to and the social context she's in, she'll move between quite a standard Southern English accent and what we might identify as quite a strong multicultural London English accent when she's speaking to other belters. And I don't know if like this is direction or if Dominique Tipper is just a particularly good actress. I think she's a particularly good actress. Either way, she really plays with the social value of her accent in different contexts.
In the book, if I'm remembering correctly, I think she's described as maybe Japanese and Jewish and something else.
Yeah, the name Naomi Nagata definitely gives that impression. Dominique Tipper is British and Dominican in origin. So continuing with that kind of, she's an actress of color.
So it seems like the, you know, showrunners of The Expanse did hire a linguist to sort of develop the context of the Belter Creole itself, but maybe should have also hired a sociolinguist to develop more in terms of the social context for which varieties of English the actors were also speaking in different contexts. Or, you know, just hire more actors of color who are already used to navigating those things.
Yeah. And I think it's just maybe my like very overly linguist brain being on while watching this show. I did also appreciate the tiny snippets that we got to see of the Belter sign language. which pops up from time to time. And it's a sign language that uses much less of the finger movements and more of your arm movements because you're in a spacesuit and you need to sign to each other in a vacuum.
You need to make the signs really big. That's very charming.
If The Expanse is about incredibly diverse languages and cultures coming together in situations like Belta Creole, The Book of Koli is about what happens in a less utopian future where society fragments and different groups of people become really isolated. And that also has really interesting implications for the English that is used in the books.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting. So The Expanse is written, the viewpoint characters all have these very standard Englishes, and they're just sort of interacting sometimes with other characters who are speaking Belter. But in The Book of Koli, the narrator himself has this sort of non-standard variety that's got a lot of features that are actually in present-day English among some groups of people, but are less associated with high levels of education or literacy in a society where systems of literacy and education are also much more broken down compared to the modern day. So it comes across as it's got this sort of futuristic but also sort of retroistic aspect of it. And sometimes you don't actually have to create a whole weird new future thing so much as extrapolate from some of the conditions that are already there in the present, which is sort of similar to what's going on in To Like the Lightning, where you're sort of extrapolating from things that are going on in the present. So Koli, as a narrator, who the book is named after, uses some regularized verbs like they was and we was, I seen, I could of, which is in, you know, many people pronounce it could of, but still write could have.
Yeah.
Or could have, coulda, and, you know, get trained to write that as could have. But it's very much something that's there in a lot of people's contemporary speech. And there are certainly varieties of English in which people say they was and I seen. And so putting that in the mouth of a character and in the sort of pen of a character who has enough literacy to be writing down this account, but doesn't have the formal training of literacy that trains you out of regionalisms, is a way of giving this sort of very richly textured voice to the whole vibe and narration of the book itself and the series itself.
I was really impressed by how these books are narrated in the first person, but it doesn't actually feel like a lot of work to get into the story. There's definitely a sense of like getting your ear in a little bit and things get even faster, but I actually found them a really easy and compelling read. I think it's because it's using all these features that we recognize already and not, you know, a new pronoun system or anything. It's actually a really compelling read.
And it's certainly not doing something like Clockwork Orange, which is something that's really rewiring the vocabulary and the grammatical structure of a language and trying to do a whole lot of stuff in a very compact way. The Book of Koli and its sequels is doing something that's much more of a light touch, where maybe once every sentence or every couple sentences, there'll be some feature that tells you, yeah, you're in this particular genre, but not like tons of words per sentence. Or there'll just be phrases in the sentence that are still around in the English that I'm used to, but are low frequency for me, that this character is using as high frequency.
Do you have some examples?
Absolutely. One quote is, I learned since then, and paid a price to learn, that them as laid claim to great wisdom most often got nothing in their store but bare scrapings. And by the same token, them as think they're ignorant, think it because they can see the edges of what they know, which you can only see when what you know is tall enough to stand on and take a look around. And so that's actually quite close to my English, but it's not quite my English. Them as laid claim to, and them as think they're ignorant, that's a phrase that I'm not unfamiliar with, but I wouldn't write in a formal context like a book.
Yep.
And Koli is writing down. And so it's got this sort of vernacular feel to it without being so far that the reader has to enter a whole new experience, but it's just consistent in every single paragraph. There's like one or two things that tell you, yeah, you're in this particular genre. Another example from a different part is, it never stops amazing me how a story can deliver you out of your own self, even in the worst of times. And again, there's your own self, which, it's not that I couldn't use, but is enough to make Koli feel like a distinct character with a distinct voice. It's sort of not that far, but the consistency of carrying through a sort of cluster of features like I seen and your own self and them as gives a particular vibe to the narrator.
I think part of that is the real stripping away of a lot of Latinate or Greek and technical words. It's all very kind of core Germanic vocabulary. To the point where, you know, there's a trans character in the book, and throughout the book, trans characters are referred to as crossed, which is just the literal English for trans from Latin.
Yeah, that's great. And it's like, it's not a book that's doing a whole bunch of super innovative stuff with gender. It's just like, trans people exist, there are trans people in this world, but talking about them in a way that feels authentic to the world building of that world by using a very Germanic term for them. And some of the times when there are words that are more Latinate or, you know, even Greek derived, they're reparsed by the character as something that feels a bit more Germanic.
It was really fun to tease out and figure out what he's talking about. I personally really appreciate the month February is just February, F-E-B-R-Y.
Great. I say it that way already.
Yeah.
I also really liked the count and seal.
This one absolutely left me scratching my head. I think I even messaged you and was just like, what am I missing?
I'm pretty sure that it's intended to be council.
Yeah. As soon as you said that, I was just like, yeah, that is the place where they all go and make deliberations. It's just the council.
They go and make deliberations at the Count and Seal, which sort of sounds like an old-timey English pub, but it's also the council. So you can have like Latinate vocabulary where the roots have been forgotten and a new folk etymology or an egg corn, which has come up to, you know, it'd be reinterpreted what the individual parts mean in the context where people aren't doing a whole lot of reading and aren't aware of the etymologies that are from these other languages.
The other thing I found super impressive about the Ramparts trilogy is that there's more than one future English at play here.
Yeah. I really liked also the character of Munono Aware, who is a sort of Japanese AI character who's from a time that's a little bit closer to our present. And we often have this temptation with AI characters to make them speak like super, super proper, super, super textbooky. But instead, she speaks sort of what I think of as maybe kind of Japanese valley girl.
She definitely has a lot of like teen girl energy going on. And that's part of why I love her so much.
Right. And so an example of her voice in this story is, I was made to keep the end user happy, 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 always blissed, never pissed. And so there's this, like, using always blissed, never pissed, that's not something that Coley would say. She's got her own distinct voice that is also not the sort of, you know, bland Hollywood narrator or sort of typical narrator. It's got this contrast that's even sharper because she's also got a distinct voice there.
And I think I also loved her for all of the kind of 20th and 21st century pop cultural references that completely go over Collie's head that she shares with us.
Yes, absolutely. Which is also a way of making her seem a certain type of futuristic or contemporary and grounding her in a time and place where Collie is, you know, saying count and seal, and she's doing things like referencing contemporary pop songs as if they're sort of aphorisms or sayings. And the reader's like, wait, that's from a song. I know that song.
As I said, I was so impressed by how easy it is to read this book for how much it is playing with language in every single sentence. But I think it also has the benefit of being a book in that you can make the characters sound how you like. It's one of the things that maybe, you know, makes a book a lot easier to manage than a TV show in terms of sociolinguistic observations, because there's just so many fewer moving parts and you don't have actors putting voices to the characters.
And sometimes the actors can also add extra dimensions that might not have been there in the original text.
For sure.
So it sort of depends on what your goals are with respect to something like that. Another book that I think people have been talking about with respect to the sort of modern day sounding voice and themes that are quite different from that is Gideon the Ninth.
Okay.
Which does these sorts of things where characters will say sort of modern day sounding expletives or, you know, words of annoyance or like that sounded awesome, but they're also in this sort of gothic-y necromancer setting, which could sound very serious and very solemn and very grave, except the characters are talking like modern day, you know, young people.
Excellent. Playing around with English on a different temporal dimension.
Right. Because like, why does future English always need to sound super serious, right? Like people these days don't always sound serious.
Yeah, I haven't read that one. I'll add it to my list. One thing I've really liked about these four different series and books and TV shows is how they really highlight how any future English needs to be grounded in a specific variety or understanding of current English and then propelled forward based on the realities of the fictional world that's being built.
And I think when a future English is very compelling, it's thinking about what am I trying to project into this world? What are the people like who are living in this environment? And how can I make that reflected in the various different kinds of linguistic choices that people are making in any particular space. For more Lingthusiasm and links to everything mentioned in this episode, go to patreon.com/lingthusiasm. I can be found as @GretchenAMcSee on Twitter, my blog is allthingslinguistic.com, and my book is Because Internet.
I tweet and blog as Superlinguo. Lingthusiasm is created and produced by Gretchen McCulloch and Lauren Gorn. Our senior producer is Claire Gorn. Our production editor is Sarah Doppiarella. Our production assistant is Martha Tsutsui Villains. And our music is Ancient City by The Triangles.
Thanks so much for being a patron.
Stay lingthusiastic.